I have to push down a lot that the first thoughts of Kathleen are not the visualization of seeing her laying on the floor in her blood, and she's clearly dead, and she's clearly been ripped to pieces, and it's horrific. And those pictures come too quickly to mind. So I work very hard again to, when I think of Kathleen, and it will come again, that when I think of her, I will think of the fun times and times we laughed and dresses we shared and fun conversations. But it, right now I'm still at the part where when I think of her, it still is very fresh, and it is, even though it was 15 years ago, I very easily see her lying there dead. So Kathleen went to McCaskey High School in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. She graduated very top of her class, to the extent she was so advanced in math and also in Latin that the public high school paid for her to take classes at Franklin and Marshall College because the high school couldn't keep up with her level of pursuing advanced information in math and in language. And in a sense, not that you can't really today be fluent in Latin, but she was almost fluent in Latin. She was a very hardworking. She had a very good IQ. As a matter of fact, Kathleen wanted to go to a top school, and she got into Duke University, where she excelled. And as I think you've mentioned earlier, she was the first woman to get into the School of Engineering at Duke University.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today, remotely, is...
Laura Richards, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, former criminal behavioral analyst at New Scotland Yard, and author of the book Policing Domestic Violence.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds.
Well, today we're continuing our coverage of the Netflix original series, The Staircase. And we're going to start right in with the 911 call. And listen in, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
911, what's your emergency?
1810 Cedar Street, please.
What's wrong?
My wife's had an accident. She's still breathing.
What kind of accident?
She fell down the stairs. She's still breathing. Please come.
Is she conscious?
What?
Is she conscious?
No, she's not conscious.
Okay.
Please.
How many stairs did you fall down?
Huh?
How many stairs?
Stairs.
How many stairs? Calm down, sir. Calm down.
No, 15, 20, I don't know. Please, get somebody here right away, please.
Okay, somebody's dispatching the ambulance while I ask you questions.
It's in Forest Hills, okay? Please.
Oh, my God. That call was filled with so many things. I mean, it's unbelievable. So, right from the start, he says, please. That is something I've heard before. How about you, Laura?
Yep, there's some familiar things that we hear in here. Absolutely. And I, you know, just to put it in its context, because this is now 2:40 in the morning, isn't it? In the early hours of Sunday, December the 9th, 2001. And this is the emergency call that he makes in Durham, North Carolina.
And what he says almost immediately is, two times he says, she's still breathing. That is an incredibly important statement. Nobody asked him if she was breathing. He volunteers this and he says, she's still breathing, as if he knows the final outcome will be death. And that's a very interesting statement to me behaviorally. What do you think, Laura?
I think it's a very interesting choice of words for sure. And I can't help but intuit that hearing this call and when you put it against others that you heard, I mean, the panting and just the sort of moaning. And I mean, I don't know, that could just be shock. Everyone behaves in a different way, but I just got the sense it didn't feel authentic. And I don't know why I felt that way. But then when I hear the words, you know, my wife's had an accident, she's still breathing.
Still breathing, as if he knows she's not going to be breathing soon. Why is that an assumption that he made? Why unless he knew that she was already not breathing. In other words, that she had already passed away and he called 911, but wanted to emphasize that she's still alive while he's calling 911 to make it look like he just happened upon this scene. But what he's doing is inadvertently leaking out information that he knows she is not breathing. Why would you say still? She's breathing, but she's unconscious. Why didn't he say she's breathing, but she's unconscious? Yeah. She's unconscious, but she's breathing. Why does he say still breathing? Because that presupposes that she is going to stop breathing. What would make him say that? And to me, I believe it's leakage that he knows she's already not breathing.
Yeah, the word is unnecessary still. And I also just think the time as well, you know, when I always put these things in context, you know, if we think about the time from they see the movie, they go outside, you know, where is this time? Like 2 hours seem to be unaccounted for with this call. And so straight away, you know, when you're hearing the words and then understanding that paramedics do arrive fairly quickly. And she says to him, you know, I'm sending someone, and tries to sort of reassure him that somebody's on their way, and also asking the detail of how many stairs, which he probably feels is irrelevant. But of course, she's trying to assess the kind of injuries that there may well be. So what we also know is the paramedics arrive fairly promptly, minutes later, and Kathleen Peterson is no longer breathing. And they also report that there was a lot of blood spatter, but most of the blood spatter was actually dry.
Which would indicate that this incident, whatever happened, happened a while ago, not just minutes ago, like Peterson was saying.
Right.
But the other thing was, going back to the call, there's a couple of things that I noticed that I've definitely seen in other very questionable 911 calls. And that is, the dispatcher asked Michael Peterson a very direct question. How many stairs did she fall down? And she had to ask him a second time. And there's a pause. He says, huh? And she asks him again. And to me, that's an indicator that there is a script that he was going off of. Whether it's written or mental script, I don't know. But when she asked a question that he didn't anticipate, he had to say, huh? And make her ask it again, as opposed to responding to it. How many stairs did she fall down? I don't know. But she's bleeding and she's on the floor. You know, none of that. He doesn't say that. He says, huh? And then there's some time, oh, I don't know, the back stairs. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, like a throwaway line. And
he sounds angry. He sounds pissed off. Like, wait, that's not the right line.
Right, exactly. And that's one thing. And then the next thing is, and this is very telling. She says, I want you to stay on so I can ask you questions until they arrive. And what does he do? He mumbles something. And he gets off the phone and she says, hello, hello. Again, something that I don't see typically in legitimate 911 calls. In legitimate 911 calls, the 911 operator is the lifeline. This is the person that is reached out to for help. And they're usually relied upon so that when there is something that happens in any intervening events, that they're right there and you don't have to go back and call 911. Usually people will hang on to that lifeline until physical people show up on the scene, and he didn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, they would hang on every word that person says. And it's the same when we do dash risk assessments, when we're talking to people very close to the event that's happened. And when they are fearful, when you're in that state of fear, then they will hang on every word that's said. So it is an interesting and slightly strange thing. I can understand the shock and the panic, but to close that lifeline down and to not, you know, hear and have that voice at the end, it's an unusual thing. But of course, you know, not everything follows the same rule. But for me, it's much more significant the still breathing being said twice.
But he still had that phony baloney, like you were saying, that breathing, like that Sebastian Burns had in the Raffaele murder case. And that's just a dead giveaway to me. That's like bad acting. That's what I always tell actors not to do when you're upset, is that phony baloney panting.
I think that there was acting going on here. I don't believe that it is something that he is actually reporting. I believe that there are a lot of indications in this, his overly dramatic statements, and then the throwaway when he's asked a direct question. First, huh? Like, I didn't anticipate this. And then when she asks him again, he says, I don't know, 14, 15, I don't know. Like, you know, just like literally a throwaway line when she's trying to gauge how seriously injured this person is. It's still breathing. The fact that he uses the word still, it's his entire almost overly dramatic demeanor. The words that are coming out of his mouth don't actually match the situation. When he's asked direct questions, he's not answering directly, but he has this almost scripted response that he wants to stick to. And the fact that he hangs up while she's trying to talk to him, it's just, those are all, to me, dead giveaways.
Well, and the other question for me is, what exactly was Michael Peterson doing between midnight and around 2:38 a.m.? You know, what happened during that missing time to cause the scalp wounds, you know, the smears, the congealing ooze, all the blood? What's happening in that 2.5 hours?
Right. And we should talk a little bit about the crime scene. I mean, Kathleen Peterson is found at the base, like half on the base that's two steps up from, I think it's the kitchen area. And then the stairwell, it's a back staircase, so it's a little tight, but it actually turns to the right. So it rotates around. So on the right-hand side, it's narrow and the steps arc out to the left-hand side. And so if you're walking on the right-hand side of those steps, on the treads, it's actually pretty risky. I mean, you could fall pretty easily. So is it reasonable that somebody might have fallen off that? Sure. But it's also completely possible that somebody was helped to fall. In other words, somebody was pushed or pulled to fall. And if that's the case, if somebody just fell one time, then I don't know how you get 7 distinct lacerations on the head. So if somebody fell on that staircase and there's only 1 or 2 steps or the side paneling on the door or the molding on the floor that could have created those lacerations, then there must have been repeated contact with them. Now, the defense argues that Kathleen must have fallen, bled for a while, and then gotten back up and slipped in the blood, her own blood, and fell again. But that would have happened again and again and again to produce those injuries.
Yeah, I mean, can you describe, you know, when I looked at those pictures, which were very shocking that they showed in the documentary of her in state there, you know, lying. I mean, she looked, if you didn't know better, she was like stabbed a million times. I mean, there's like blood everywhere, you know, all over the front of her, all over the walls. You would never think in a million years that this is somebody who'd just fallen down the stairs.
You're right. It's a very difficult thing to reconcile.
There were 10,000 spatters of blood on the walls, 10,000, and up on the ceiling as well.
And I talked to Dr. Lee about this because he did go in and analyze this crime scene. And he believed that she did fall. And he believed that after she fell, she got up, slipped, and fell again. But that she aspirated some blood and coughed it out. And that's why there's so many blood spatters, that it's actually a result of coughing and not cast off or something like that. And, yeah, you know, I'm prepared to believe him to a certain extent, but nothing that he says dissuades me from believing that she was helped to fall because of the force of the falls and because of the repeated nature of the falls. I believe if she was trying to get back up, that somebody was helping her fall back again. She was wearing a loose sweatshirt. And it could be very easily grabbed from behind and pulled when somebody is going up those precarious curved steps. That's a very vulnerable time. And I believe that somebody could have yanked on her sweatshirt and smashed her head down against the wall, against the floor, against the stairs, against the floorboards, against the molding, all those things are possible, quote, weapons to create those kinds of wounds. Unfortunately, the prosecution came up with some theory about a missing blow poke.
Yeah.
And I've actually had blow pokes. I've actually seen what they're made of, and they're kind of brass or copper. They're hollow so that you can blow through them and reignite a fire that's waning. And they have a little hook, usually a heavy weighted hook at the end. But the fact is that they're a hollow tube, and they're not steel. They're not iron. They're a lighter, thin metal. And if you hit somebody over the head with one of those, especially if you hit them hard enough to create a laceration like that, they're going to deform. They're going to bend. They may even break. And in fact, if you recall, during the series, when the prosecution's blood spatter expert did do demonstrations, in the first or second hit, the whole end of it broke off.
It did. Yeah, in that ridiculous demonstration.
The courtroom took on a different form today as 16 jurors emptied out of sheriff's vans and took a tour of the Peterson home. Until now, the staircase, the kitchen, the hallway, it was all impersonal. The News and Observer's Damaris Lee was allowed inside as a representative of the media.
Several of them stood in the stairwell, went up about three or four steps and kind of waved their arms to kind of get a sense of the area, to get a sense if you can fall back. They all looked back behind them.
Jurors were quiet. They all took notes. They looked at the kitchen cabinets, at blood spatter. They walked around the other side of the house to the pool.
But they were very serious, and they seemed to be consuming a lot. It's one thing to see it in the pictures. I guess it's another thing to see it in person.
Going back, Jim, to Henry, mm-hmm. and just talking about the injuries, did he pass comments on that? Because obviously there were seven deep gashes on the back of the scalp. And, you know, the cause of death, obviously blunt force trauma, but did she die from blood loss, for example? And if so, you know, because there was a lot of blood, how long would that have taken? And I don't recall whether Henry passed comment on that or whether the medical examiner did, of what the time period would be of her suffering from those injuries to the point where she's still breathing to her actually, you know, no longer breathing.
I don't know. And that would have been a Werner Spitz question. I didn't get to talk to Werner about this, but he is also somebody who consulted with the defense on this case. The thing about, you know, what you ask about Dr. Lee, I mean, I do believe that it's possible that, let's say, somebody fell from the 10th step and they fell back and they smacked their head on one of the rungs and then bumped down to the next one and then bumped down to the next one and then bumped down to the next one. That could cause multiple lacerations like that. But I don't think there's anybody that believes that she was on the 7th or the 10th step. I believe that she was on the 3rd or 4th step, and that's what's consistent with the blood spatter pattern. And so I think it's a much more difficult thing to figure out how she could get 7 distinct lacerations. But the other thing, and I don't know, and maybe I have to watch this whole series again, but I believe in the last or the second to last episode. Now, I don't know if you want to go into this. You mentioned the cause of death, Laura. I believe that the prosecutor said her cause of death was strangulation, not asphyxiation, not exsanguination, but strangulation. Now, I never saw the autopsy report. Obviously, we never heard that before or after in the documentary series. But I believe I heard that.
Yeah, that was said.
You did too, right? So, what the fuck? It's not possible for this to have been a fall.
Right.
A fall alone. It could be a fall followed by strangulation. But if her cause of death was strangulation, I believe there's only one person who could have done that. One person alone who said she was still alive and breathing. So his attempt to make it look like she was still alive actually condemns him and only him for this crime. And I don't care what you say about owls. They can't strangle a human being.
No, and the time period is a problem. That, you know, yeah. potential 90 minutes, 2 hours, that's the question for me, as well as the injuries. And, you know, he does have blood in the crotch of his shorts. And they believe that he recently splashed his shorts with water as well, and that there was some form of cleaning up going on with the footprint. So, you know, just the time window is the biggest question of those missing 2.5 hours with those.
Right. So he would have us believe that he was outside for those 2.5 hours. This is a man clad in a pair of shorts.
In December.
In December. Right. At night. By a pool.
I mean, even if he was out there, Jim, you know, he could, well, we see him smoking his pipe the whole time. Maybe he could have been, but he wasn't wrapped up. He wasn't wearing more clothes. I mean, that's a long time to sit outside. And
right. So he would say that he was drinking and maybe he fell asleep for a while, or he was just sitting out contemplating his navel. I don't know. But the fact is that he says he was out there for that entire time period. And I think the weather speaks to the contrary of that. I don't believe he could have been doing that. And so that opens the possibility. I don't know for sure, but the possibility that what really happened is he went in with her, that she left and she came out and told him what she found and told him to leave. And he followed her back in. And when she started going up the stairs, that he yanked her backwards and slammed her into the doorway or slammed her into the landing and slammed her again and slammed her again. And that that's why she died. And because she still was breathing, he strangled her to death. That's what it looks like to me.
Can that be shown in the autopsy that was the order that she was strangled?
Oh, absolutely.
Strangled?
If her cause of death was strangulation, it had to have been after she sustained the wounds, because otherwise the blood loss wouldn't be anywhere near the same. Her heart was still pumping when the injuries to her head occurred. That's why there's so much blood. But here's the thing, you know, even about Dr. Lee's statement about her having aspirated blood, the fact is that the injuries were in the back of her head. All right, now let's look at that. Dr. Lee said she aspirated blood. She wasn't bleeding internally. She couldn't have aspirated from the inside. So she must have aspirated it from the outside. Well, the only way for that to happen is if her head injuries are in the back. The back of her head must have been up, and her mouth had to have been down. But again, you can't aspirate blood if the blood can't drip into your mouth.
Yeah. Right.
So there's just no way for that to happen under those circumstances.
All respect to Dr. Lee, though, this is the one part that didn't make any sense, because he was saying that, you know, the blood dripped down her face and into her nose or something. But she would have to have, like, tuberculosis for that amount of blood to be on the wall. I mean, how could she have aspirated all of that? That just didn't ring true for my layman's
It doesn't
eyes.
Make sense unless her position had been changed multiple times. And she must have, either been, you know, bleeding on the floor and then had her face put into that blood and she breathed it in, a pool of blood.
Yeah.
And then turned over and started coughing.
Yeah.
Or somebody poured blood into her mouth, or some mysterious thing other than that happened. I just don't understand how you can aspirate that much blood, spray it all over the walls, and yet still have the injuries on the back of your head. Physics is defied by that explanation.
It is. And I think, you know, my sense of it was that they probably did go inside together. From the information from the family was that his study was sort of almost under lock and key, that he was very private about his things. And so I believe she probably had to ask permission to use his computer and, you know, probably ask him nicely to be able to use it. So again, he was possibly controlled in various aspects of his life. And perhaps that argument did happen. And within that 2.5 hour period, because it is still the sequence of events that do not make sense. David Rudolph not asking him about that time sequence also is a problem. And sometimes you don't ask the question because you don't want to know the answer.
There you go.
Yeah. And there I do wonder, because do you remember when we hear him doing the kind of like the tour of the house, he gives his account. And actually, Lisa, you asked before about whose account was it, about, you know, what they were doing before. Well, it's his when he's talking to camera and showing them around. He basically says that, and he doesn't specify a time, but he says Kathleen went inside, and I quote, because she had a conference call in the morning. And Kathleen was concerned about her work. She was vice president at Nortel, a huge tech company that was in trouble. And then he quotes, and he basically says, that was the last time I saw Kathleen alive. And then he pauses, and then he says, no, she was alive when I found her, but barely. And barely is an interesting word choice.
Right.
And, you know, why isn't the call an immediate, he's calling for a paramedic because he needs medical attention immediately. There just seems to be this time lag, which I just still cannot make sense of.
Right. And the other thing is that he called back 911. And what he says is, she just stopped breathing. Again, just. Why is he adding just? Because he wants to emphasize the fact that for the time period up until now, she was breathing. Why didn't he just say she stopped breathing? Why did he have to say she just stopped breathing? He knew that he told people moments earlier that she was, quote, still breathing. And now he says she just stopped breathing. He's trying to put a timestamp on when she died so that that time gap that you're talking about, Laura, does not come into the equation. He's trying to cover that up by saying she just stopped breathing. Again, inadvertently leaking out information that he didn't want us to know, but we know because he used those words.
And what's your thoughts, Jim, on two separate calls?
I have heard two calls when people have disconnected because things are actively going on. In other words, there are situations where you call 911 because somebody is attacking your partner. There's a situation when you call 911 because you've cut yourself and you're trying to stop the bleeding. And so you can't like hold the phone and do that. So you stop doing that. So there are times where the incidents themselves create a situation where you need to break off that call. In this case, that is not the case. He wasn't saying, and he didn't even attempt to, as far as we know, administer CPR. There was no indication that he had bloody lips or a bloody face and that he was giving her chest compressions. If she had fallen and she was still breathing and she was unconscious and she stopped breathing, why didn't he do that? Because he wasn't attempting to save her life, in my mind. So there was no actual legitimate reason for him to break off the 911 call and call back in this case. In this case, he should have stayed on. And I bet you anything, if he was on when he told the dispatcher she just stopped breathing, she would have said, do you know CPR? Initiate compressions, breathe every 5 compressions or whatever. That would have been the sequence of events until the EMTs got there. Instead, he's reporting she's still breathing, she just stopped breathing, and there's no attempt at all. There's no evidence of any attempt at CPR. And again, very telling. It's what his behavior screams out, that he wasn't trying to save her life.
So the absence of that, and, you know, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he doesn't know CPR, which I think everyone should be trained in that. So let's
But she could have coached him in
it. Right. So she could have talked him through it. But the other part is, if you find your partner, you know, your beloved, in a state, you know, covered in blood, your instinct is to cradle them. And certainly if you know, they're breathing or not breathing, so where it's the absence of blood on him, I would expect him to be cradling her and holding her, even if he's not. You know, he would be covered in blood, given the amount of blood that's there, but there's an absence of that too. So what was he doing in that time? If he's not giving her CPR, he's not cradling her and holding her, so what is he doing across that 2.5-hour window?
Right. Well, I think, you know, we can only speculate, but what it looks like is he was maybe changing his clothes, maybe cleaning up the crime scene, maybe panicking at first and then recovering and coming up with a plan and scripting in his mind what he's going to say to 911 and then executing that call and hanging up on 911 while she's saying, hello, hello. We've heard that before.
We have. And that may well be it. I mean, it does appear that someone has tracked and then cleaned up and there's a set of bloody footprints. But there's certainly a lot of questions. And his behavior, like I said, there are some leakage points. And you know, there are some moments where I feel that there is an anger with him that lurks below the surface. And he's good at masking it at times, but there are these little flashes. And when we talk about the acting side, well, we know that he can act because he's maintained this double life for a number of decades, and neither his children suspected that or his partners. So we know he's capable of putting on a public face and appearing as one thing where in fact something else is going on entirely.
Right, and this is not at all some kind of judgment about his lifestyle.
Yes.
But it's an indicator that he was not one faithful to her, that this was not the fairy tale romance that he projected it to be. And then when there is some, you know, actual evidence that comes forward, his behavior is very much, oh, well, what did he tell you? Oh, well, what do you know? Before he wants to give up the actual information.
Yes, I think that's a very interesting moment, the whole Brad discussion, because at no point does he, I think it's when Ron is talking to him and saying, well, I spoke to Brad, and at no point does he say, well, he's a liar, and why did you go and speak to him? He just waits. Well, what did he say? He just wants to know what was imparted. And so he is smart in the way that he approaches things. And I think later on we see that as well in some very different changes of demeanor. There's a big health problem at some point. And he feels terrible and he's walking incredibly slowly. And everything is saying that, you know, he says he's got a high pain threshold, but he's feeling terrible and he can barely move because of the bracelet on his leg. And literally within, you know, the next day, you see him moving relatively quickly, pain-free. And I just noticed that it felt very, very different in terms of how he was projecting this image. And again, acting a part, playing a part. And there are other times where he is authentic, and I can see that too. But he is a complex character. And I think he is very conscious of the cameras and the image and the persona and how he will be judged. And, you know, his defense team have spoken to him about that too. So there are these moments where they're buttoned down. And I think the family are, and whether that's because they're going through something incredibly stressful, whether it's because they're very conscious of the cameras and what they are projecting. But I do think some moments are very well rehearsed in his own head.
Yeah, and Laura, while we're talking about that, there is a point in the series where they actually do have a coach for his testimony. And it's very interesting, his interaction with that person. And it's very interesting how manipulable he makes himself. In other words, he says, you know, oh, I want to do the right thing. I want to come off the best I can. But the fact is that throughout this entire documentary, you see him behaving in ways that are so self-centered and so unfocused on the real issue here, which is that he says that he didn't kill her, that she died this horrific death, and there's no sympathy, there's no empathy, there's nothing, and there's moments where he says, oh, you know, now that I'm out of prison, I can finally grieve. Well, wait a minute. You know, that's about you. What about your kids who lost their mother? What about them? Why is it that they are not important to you? You know, what about the fact that you have just been, you know, charged with the murder of your wife? What about that? Like, don't you think that affects your children, her children? But there's nothing coming out of his mouth about that stuff, and it's telling.
Though I do remember the scene where the two lawyers are discussing Kathleen's death, and he's sitting there, and as they go over the details, he starts to cry and get very visibly upset and gets up and leaves the room, and the lawyers are like, oh, we can't talk about this in front of him. And I didn't buy it at all. It just seemed like so much showmanship for the cameras. And I hate to say that, but it just, everything just rung so false to me. All of his reactions.
I think there was some authenticity in parts, but when he's talking about himself and the trauma on himself and his, you know, experience of prison. But I think the toast is an interesting toast when they have the champagne. And I'd actually, making my notes, you know, he's asked the question, what's the first thing you're going to do when you leave the courthouse? And I wrote, drink wine. And then it cuts to the next scene and he's doing a champagne toast. And, you know, he's toasting to the children and saying about family. But I felt there would have been the place where, and to, you know, Kathleen, we should toast Kathleen and we should remember her. And they're the points where he should be talking about her, but it's the absence. And I agree with you, Jim. There are moments in the documentary where it's placed, and I feel that it has been placed and pieced together, but it hasn't come from him in the authentic moments when I would expect it to appear. And there's right. The absence. He's very articulate and very self-indulgent when it comes to his feelings and the impact. And I can see he's trying to be stoic at points for his children. But there, again, there's this moment of leakage when I think it is, who are the sons? It's not Clayton, it's Todd, I think. And, you know, he's basically trying to talk to him about his girlfriend and about what's going on. And Michael Peterson says, well, I'm going to be, you know, whatever happens, happens in terms of the appeal. He said, well, let's not talk about me. Let's talk about you. And so his son says, well, you know, I've been dating someone very special in my life called Jasmine. And then there's a load of noise in the background and you can see him get very angry very quickly and stand up saying, it's so loud in here. I can't hear you and I can't hear you. And that's the kind of like little cool fury that I see these right. moments of with him. Even the first moment, he's trying to be stoic. And the next moment, he just snaps and he's angry. And it's lost the kind of the intimate moment with his son. It changes the whole dynamic. And that there are those moments across the whole documentary where I see his temper being triggered.
And I think you were right earlier saying that he's a complicated human being. And we all are. He is a very articulate human being. Mm-hmm. He's somebody who picks and chooses his words in a way that tells you he's a smart person. But he's not criminally sophisticated. And these are the things that give these kind of offenders away. And the fact is that maybe he didn't expect things from his past to come out, but they came out. And when they did, it was a bombshell. I think that I did that, and I don't think we should discuss it now, Germany, but that should be the next episode.
I agree. I think there's a lot to talk about with Germany and, you know, various bombshells that just keep coming throughout this particular case and the 15 years, because there's been some recent bombshell as well that I would like to talk about.
Yeah, I'll say. Just before you wrap up, though, I want to say that, you know, his behavior towards his children I found fascinating because he has this quality that some people I know have where when he's talking to you, you feel like the most important person in the room because he's so attentive to them. I mean, he's like staring at his daughters as they're talking and just devouring every word. And I thought that was just so interesting. I mean, my own father doesn't do that to me.
Yeah. Can you say charismatic psychopath?
Okay, there you go. I was wondering if you had a way to describe that. So
yeah, I mean, it's, I'm not saying he's, I haven't diagnosed him. I can't do that. But what I'm saying is that's something that many charismatic psychopaths can do. They can make you feel very special. First of all, they love kind of the thrill in their lives. So they tend to have people like an entourage around them because they're always thrill seeking. They're always doing things that are interesting. And this show, this documentary series is thrilling and interesting for these people. And so he is able to make people feel special. And that gives him access to them. And that is probably what got him close to Kathleen in the first place. And even though he didn't seem broken up by her death the way we would expect, he must have made her feel like she was extremely special to him. And if that's the case, how much more devastating would it be to find out that over the course of their marriage, that he had been meeting and hooking up for sexual encounters with men?
Oh, exactly. I mean, she would have felt it was a complete sham. I mean, those, you know, 8 years of her marriage, you would be devastated and you would question everything.
And you might throw him out, and that might beget a terrible argument and the desire to get rid of her. I mean, she has this $1.8 million life insurance policy, right?
Yep. And as we know, sometimes in the blink of an eye, Jim, these things happen. You know, it may not be such a planned event, but if there's wine or, you know, alcohol, drugs involved, then things can get out of hand very quickly.
Yeah, lowering inhibitions and impulsivity rises and people do things that they wouldn't normally do.
And I believe with him, alcohol does feature. And I think there are elements of control. I think some of his control tactics are very subtle, and some of them are about his charm and charisma. And other elements, you know, I'm still reading into, just about him, you know, locking his study and not giving access to the computer and being very closed down in certain aspects of his life. And I'd like to dig into that a little bit more deeply.
Well, when we come back, we're going to dig a lot more deeply into the case of Kathleen Peterson and hopefully come to some resolution as to whether this was a murder or an accident or some bizarre natural event. An owl attack.
Don't talk about the owl, Jim. We're not bringing the owl in.
Well, I don't want to bring it in, but they certainly, if you go on the internet,
the
you'll see that people are talking
about
it.
Yeah, they are.
That's so ridiculous.
Yeah, well, that's good. We can debunk it. But yeah, our listeners definitely, that's one of their, you know, tongue-in-cheek questions for you guys. But
all right, well,
yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much. And we'll be back with more on the Netflix original series, The Staircase. Till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.